All right, after that wonderful quiz, we move on to a section on 1st and 2nd Samuel and 1st and 2nd Kings here in Old Testament Survey. This will not be as long a class because of the quiz, but we needed the quiz. You did very well. Now, these four books are a continuation of the history books of the Bible. Remember, we have gone from the Pentateuch into another series of books called the history books, the historical books. The events of 1 Samuel span approximately 100 years, from 1100 B.C. to 1000 B.C., and describe the lives of Samuel, Saul, and young David. The events of 2 Samuel cover another 40 years. The book of 1 Kings spans about 350 more years, describing the reigns of Solomon, and continues the story of kings over a divided kingdom, Israel and Judah, concluding in 2 Kings with the final overthrow and deportation of both Israel and Judah's people to the empires of first Assyria and then Babylon, respectively. Now, 1 Samuel. It doesn't actually say, like when you pick up the book of Galatians, it says it's written by Paul. When you pick up Romans, it says it's written by Paul. Peter's written by Peter, so on and so forth. When you pick up 1 Samuel, it doesn't say it was written by. But probably, I have no problem with believing that it's just written by Samuel. It's about Samuel and his interaction with these two men of leadership, Saul and King David. There were other prophets at the time who were also called recorders, which actually recorded events in an official capacity, and they were prophets. So I would say Nathan and Gad were possibly involved with it as well, just for your information. Now, the date of writing, 1000 B.C. is a good enough guess. The purpose of the book, 1 Samuel records the history of Israel in the land of Canaan as they move from the rule of judges to being a unified nation under kings. The prophet Samuel emerges as the last judge, and he anoints the first two kings of Israel, Saul, and 40 years later, he anoints David. Key verses. Let's look at these two scriptures real quick. 1 Samuel chapter 8 and verse 6.
What books comprise the history books?
Okay, they run all the way from Ruth, well, Joshua, Judges, Ruth, all the way through to Esther, Nehemiah, and Ezra. And then you get Job, all the way until you get Ezra. There are like 12 history books.
But not Job.
No, Job is not a history book. They call it poetic, although they are... I personally don't like the term poetic because it makes it seem like it's just a story, but it actually is. These are the books of the heart. Okay. They are the heart of the Bible.
Is Nehemiah and Esther history
Esther, Nehemiah, and Ezra are all history books, yes. Okay? So, 1 Samuel chapter 6. Did I say 6? Is that right? 8, 6, and 7. 8, 6, and 7. But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, "Give us a king to judge us." And Samuel prayed unto the Lord. And the Lord said unto Samuel, this is a key verse, "Hearken unto the voice of the people and all that they say unto thee." Listen to what God's telling Samuel. You go ahead and do what they say. "For they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me that I should not reign over them." According to all, how far do I read? Just 6 and 7. Now, so, beware of rejecting God's rule in your life is the first thing. The second one is 1 Samuel 15:22, which is, "To obey God is always better than any sacrifice you may try and make." 1 Samuel 15:22. "And Samuel said, Hath the Lord his great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices, as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is always better than sacrifice, and to hearken than the fat of rams." God's not as pleased with anything you do if it's not obeying. There's no second best. Brief summary. 1 Samuel can neatly be divided into two sections. The first one deals with Samuel. The second one deals with Saul. The book starts with the miraculous birth of Samuel in answer to his mother's earnest prayer. As a child, Samuel lived and served in the temple. God singled him out as a prophet, and the child's first prophecy was one of judgment on the corrupt priests. The Israelites go to war with their enemies, the Philistines, Philistines. The Philistines, you have the next word there, spell it, capture the Ark of the Covenant, but when the Lord sends judgment upon them, the Philistines gladly return the Ark. That was when, remember, they put it in their temple, and their god, Dagon, keeps falling down in front of the Ark. And finally, its head falls off, and its arms break off. Samuel calls Israel to repentance, and then to a victory over the Philistines, and they have a great victory. The people of Israel wanted to be like the other nations, desire now a king. Samuel is displeased by their demands, but the Lord tells them that it is not Samuel's leadership they're rejecting, but his own. After warning the people what having a king would mean to them, Samuel appoints a Benjamite named Saul, who is crowned in Mizpah. And they love Saul. Saul is this tall hunk of a basketball player who probably could play hurling and soccer at the same time. This guy was one top-notch guy, but he was unspiritual. Okay, he did not walk with God. And so, don't always look on the outside, because on the outside they may look, smell, taste like the great thing, but if the heart's not right, like David's ultimately is, you're going to be getting into trouble. That goes for relationships and things like that. Saul enjoys initial success defeating the Ammonites in battle, but then makes a series of errors and judgments. First of all, he presumptuously offers a sacrifice. When Samuel's supposed to be there and he delays, Saul does it, and he thinks he can do it. He then makes a foolish vow at the expense of his son Jonathan. When Israel was cowering over in one section, and Jonathan takes his armor bearer, his caddy with him to go see the enemy, they take on a garrison of the Philistines, and they start fighting them, and they got the battle going, and the Philistines became disoriented, and they started to become defeated, and all of a sudden Saul's looking at this entire situation. He hasn't sent any order to battle, and yet the battle started, so he's really mad. He wants to be in control. He's a control freak. And he says, whoever has done this, we want to... He goes on further, and he says, nobody's allowed to eat, okay, and eat anything. They all are fasting on this thing. And when he finds out that his son Jonathan, he actually makes it under a penalty of death. He says, whoever eats during this is going to die. I don't care if it's my son or not. But Jonathan doesn't hear the vow, doesn't hear the command. And so he finds some honey and he eats it and he passes it on to his men. And Saul says, he has to die. And the people stop Saul from carrying out that order. You see, Saul was so intense. He had to have control of everything. And if he, he didn't care whether his son died at the rashness of his own mouth, which was pretty cruel. He disobeys the Lord's direct command to annihilate the Amalekites. That's where Samuel comes up to him and says to obey his better sacrifice, because he could have, or he should have, wiped out that nation when they went into battle, but they kept the best of the flocks, and he even took the king, Agag, and he toys with him, and he's taunting him instead of just killing him. This was not to gloat. This was just, these guys are wicked. These guys have abused and destroyed life. It's time to just wipe them out. And he's toying with them. And so, but he actually acts like, I wanted to, but the people, they did this and that. And he starts to make excuse. Ultimately, verse number 4, as a result of Saul's rebellion, God chooses another man to take Saul's place as king. When God removes his blessings from Saul, an evil spirit drives Saul toward madness. And it's true, man. You serve one of two masters. The wages of sin is always death. Meanwhile, Samuel travels to a little village called Bethlehem to anoint a young man named David as the next king of Israel. Later, David had his famous confrontation with Goliath, the Philistine, and becomes a national hero. David serves indeed in Saul's court, marries Saul's daughter, befriends Saul's son. Saul himself grows jealous of David's success and popularity and attempts to kill David. David flees, and so begins an extraordinary period of adventure, intrigue, and romance while running from the life from King Saul. Running for his life from King Saul. Your Bible is one of the most amazing books. Supernatural aid, David narrowly but consistently eludes the bloodthirsty Saul. Through it all, David maintains his integrity and his friendship with Jonathan. since they're the best of friends. Near the end of the book, Samuel has died and Saul is a lost man. On the eve of a battle with the Philistines, Saul seeks for direction. Having rejected God, he finds no help from heaven. So he seeks counsel from a witch instead, the witch at Endor. During that seance, Samuel's soul rises from the dead to give one last prophecy that Saul would die in battle the next day. The prophecy is fulfilled, and Saul's three sons, including Jonathan, die in the battle, and Saul commits suicide. And here's your practical application. The tragic story of Saul is a study in wasted opportunity. Here is a man who had it all, honor from God and man, authority, riches, good looks, and more. Yet he died in despair, terrified of his enemies, and knowing that he had failed his nation, his family, and his God. Saul made the mistake of thinking disobedience didn't matter. Like many today, he believed that a sensible motive will compensate for bad habit. Well, I was sincere. I really tried.
Okay.
Perhaps his power went to his head and he began to think that he was above the rules. Somehow he developed a low opinion of God's commands and a high opinion of himself. Even when confronted with his wrongdoing, he attempted to justify himself, and that's when God rejected him. Saul's problem is one we all face, a problem of the heart. Remember, when God went looking for another king, he said, I found a man with a right heart. Obedience to God's will is necessary for success. And if we in pride rebel against him, we will set up ourselves for a loss. David, on the other hand, did not seem like much at first. He was the eighth son of Jesse. The eighth son. He's the last in this big family. It's like he's the runt kid. Even Samuel was tempted to overlook him. But God sees the heart and saw in David a man who would follow after his own heart. The humility and integrity of David, coupled with his boldness for the Lord and his commitment to prayer, set a good example for all of us. Now, a simple outline of 1 Samuel. I say simple. Never simple, but it's fairly okay. Number one, birth and early years of Samuel. Roman numeral 2, A, abuse of the Ark of the Covenant. Samuel's leadership of Israel. And that's when the Ark of the Covenant is stolen. Roman numeral 3, chapter 16 to chapter 30 is all about Saul and King David. David enters Saul's service as a harp player. Ultimately, David kills the a hundred Philistines, I think it was, in order to prove that he was worthy to marry Saul's daughter, Michal. M-I-C-H-A-L. It's not A-E-L, like we would say, but Michal. Saul versus David down there. God protects David for the first three chapters, two chapters, and then David protects his men, and he does a very good job. Roman number 4, you have Saul's final battle.
Is that the Mikhail, is it?
You might pronounce it Mikhail, yeah. But that almost sounds Russian, you know, Mikhail Gorbachev. But it does sound like a boy's name. But haven't you met all these girls? I mean, when was the last time you met a girl? I meet girls in America all the time. Call her Sam, Samantha, Bobby Joe. Is a girl's name. That's a girl's name, Bobby Joe. Oh man. Yeah. So anyway, no, but Michal. But that doesn't prove that I know how to pronounce it. It might be Mikhail. All right, 2 Samuel now. The author. Probably again Nathan and Gad. Why? Because Samuel's dead in 2 Samuel. So he probably didn't write his epitaph. The date of writing, they span. 1 Samuel runs 100 years. 2 Samuel runs another 40 years. Sometime around 960. All right? The purpose of writing, to provide an inspired record of the reign of King David. Key verses. Go to 2 Samuel 7. 2 Samuel 7 and 16. That's a temple. 2 Samuel 7 and 16. This is God speaking to David. And thine house, talking about your, not just your building, but talking about your home. And thy kingdom shall be established forever before thee. Thy throne shall be established forever That's an incredible statement. Every king wants to live forever. Every king wants his children, his grandchildren, to be on the throne. But it never happens. Never happens. Except with David. Okay. And David's throne. That's why when Jesus came, they called him, "Thou son of David." They knew this is somebody who was supposed to come and continue the throne. Another one. 2 Samuel 24:24. And this is David. He buys a threshing floor. He buys just an old part of a barn. And he wants it in order to worship God there and have the ark there because a miracle takes place. And the man who owns the barn wants to give it to the king and listen to the king in his response. And the king said unto Arunan, "Nay, but I will surely buy it of thee at a price. Neither will I offer burnt offerings unto the Lord my God of that which doth cost me nothing." So David bought the threshing floor and the oxen for 50 shekels of silver. When you worship God, you don't it would be terrible if you thought that say you're giving a gift, say you're giving a special gift to missions, or you're giving your tithe or whatever, and you say, "Joseph, I need some money so I can give to God." So for the reason is buying, he gives you 50 euros and you put the 50 euros in. "Well, I did my giving today." No, you didn't. You took somebody else's money and you gave it. All right? It's not a gift until it came from you. Right? And David says, "I can't worship God until it costs me something." All right. A brief summary. The book of 2 Samuel is broadly divided also into two sections. David's triumphs and David's troubles. The last part of the book, chapters 21 to 24, is an appendix which contains some further details of his reign. And they're not in chronological order. They're kind of like, just a catch-up section. The book begins with David receiving news of the death of Saul and his sons. He proclaims a time of mourning. Soon afterward, David is crowned king over Judah, while Ish-bosheth, one of Saul's surviving sons, is crowned king over Israel. Again, there's a lot of loyalty to Saul, and they just thought the next guy in line should be the king's son. So Ish-bosheth is the surviving son, and they crown him instantly as king. And so a civil war follows, but Ish-bosheth is murdered, and the Israelites ask David to reign over them as well. David moves the country's capital from a place called Hebron in the south to Jerusalem, and later moves the Ark of the Covenant there as well in anticipation of building a permanent temple. David plans to build a temple in Jerusalem. His plans are vetoed by God. Who then promises David the following things? One, that David would have a son to rule after him. That David's son would build the temple. That the throne occupied by David's lineage would be established forever, and that God would never take his mercy from David's house. Okay. David leads Israel to victory over many of the enemies which surrounded them. He also shows kindness to the family of Jonathan. Now, Jonathan has a son, and his son's name is Mephibosheth. And you spell that Mephibosheth. Mephibosheth. Now, that's a very important name. Mephibosheth is a great picture of God's grace as well. Here's a crippled son of a failure of a king, and totally ruined life. He can do nothing for himself. He has nothing to offer. And yet David loves him. David brings him into the family and feeds him and takes care of him like a prince. Jonathan's crippled son is Mephibosheth, and he treats him as a son. It's a great picture of mercy and grace. Then David falls. He lusts for a beautiful woman named Bathsheba, commits adultery with her, and then has her husband murdered. Nice guy. When Nathan, somebody asked him, said, there are several things you learn from the Bible. One is, would you trust Noah with a bottle of Chardonnay? And secondly, would you trust David with your wife? When Nathan the prophet confronts David with his son, David confesses, and God graciously forgives. However, the Lord tells David that trouble would arise from within his own household. Trouble does come when David's firstborn son, Amnon, rapes his half-sister, Tamar. In retaliation, Tamar's brother, Absalom, kills Amnon. Absalom, can you imagine a home that all of a sudden has got killers in it? Rapists. This is his home life. Absalom then flees Jerusalem rather than face his father's anger. Later, Absalom leads a revolt against David, and some of David's former associates join in that rebellion. David's king and his son is dethroning him.
This is part of the
open the door for the devil to come in. Yeah. You open the door by sinning yourself. You're allowing the devil to have a foothold, and it's pretty hard to kick him out. So yeah, he reaps. He gets forgiven. He should have died, being an adulterer and a murderer. Should have died. So it actually
he's forgiven. So, but that's like his punishment.
But he still gets scars. Yeah.
Yeah.
He still gets chastened, and so does, and his home gets hurt. David is forced out of Jerusalem, and Absalom sets himself up as king for a short time. Absalom's no good of a king. He's full of bitterness. Absalom is finally overthrown, however, and against David's wishes is killed by David's general, Joab. David had expressly commanded that when you capture and corner Joab, when you capture and corner Absalom, bring him to me. I'll deal with him. But Joab doesn't want David to deal with him. He wants him dead. You know, and Joab's he's a cut and dry guy. He says, if there's any threat, kill him. there's no reason to have mercy. There's no reason to bring him in. He saw things on black and white. And Joab was a danger. Okay? And you don't want to have a Joab attitude. You don't want to have a Joab in a church. Because a Joab comes along and says, oh, I'm so-and-so. Let's kick him out. And they're deadly, deadly. But he's a great general. When David needed a war fought, Joab won every battle. He was great for fighting. But man, in the family, he was a nightmare. So, David mourns his fallen son. And boy, some of the most tortured scriptures. David cries out, oh, Absalom, Absalom, oh, my son Absalom. He is really broke up because he feels guilty himself. Okay? A general feeling of unrest plagues the remainder of David's reign. The men of Israel threaten to split from Judah, and David must suppress another whole uprising against him. So he has problem after problem. The book's appendix includes information concerning a 3-year famine in the land, a Song of David, a record of the exploits and the victories of David's bravest warriors, and David's sinful census in the ensuing plague. God judges David one more time because he takes a census of the people. Now, the reason why the census was wrong was this. Normally, when you get ready to go for battle, you call everybody out of the village into the center square, and you number them. You number the men, and you say, all right, there are 400 men here ready to fight. There are 3,000 in this village ready to fight. And he went around, and he said, take a numbering of all the people. And Joab said, why? There's no battle. Just do it. And he got everybody all prepared for battle, and there's no battle. It was him just liking to relive the glory days of, boy, I love the fight. You know, I just want to feel important again, because he was growing old. God says, don't do this. And then it got serious. And the people are like, well, what's going to happen now? And he should have just stepped down from leadership, but he didn't. And so it actually brought in a plague on the people. Practical application. Anyone can fall. Underline those words. Even a godly man like David, who truly desired to follow God and who was richly blessed by God, he was susceptible to temptation. David's sin with Bathsheba should be a warning to all of us to guard against the heart. 1 Corinthians 10:12 says, wherefore, let him that thinketh he standeth take heed lest he fall. God is gracious to forgive even the most awful of sins when we truly repent. However, healing the wound caused by sin does not always erase the scar. Sin has a natural consequence, and even after he was forgiven, David reaped what he had sown. How much better to avoid sin in the first place rather than having to seek forgiveness later. Now, outline. David first, at the beginning of the chapter of the book, if David mourns for Saul and Jonathan. David becomes king in his path of becoming a king there. David's early success as a king, he captures Jerusalem. Now, Jerusalem wasn't just a little set of tents. He captures it from the Jebusites. Yes, ma'am.
2H. David is finally anointed.
Ah, it has been 7 years since David's anointing by Samuel. Mom, you better go get Joel. They just arrived. Okay. It has been 7 years. David captures Jerusalem from the Jebusites, and he makes it his capital. And he actually has a portion of the city named for himself. It's called the City of David. It's his own little living quarters, his own place that he lived in. David's difficulties. Okay. David and Bathsheba, through that horrible, horrible thing, he and Bathsheba do have a son after the first one that dies, and that son's name is Solomon. One second, let me give. Okay, so we got the birth of Solomon down there on 8 and 4. You've got D, Absalom's rebellion against God and his family. Now your map there, the birth of Solomon. David and Bathsheba, something good does come out of it, and that's the wisest man who ever lived, Solomon, a man of peace instead of war, like David was. Now, your picture there, your graphic there, is showing you where the Philistines are, the eternal enemies of Israel. You got the kingdoms of David and Solomon, but you've got the Philistines along the Mediterranean Sea. That's where the Philistines were, and that was the nation of Israel. If you'll notice, the little outlined area there in brown, this outline here, see there, that is the 1948 description of where Israel is today. This is Israel, but Israel now includes all of that. So this is where Israel is today, including the land of the Philistines. But all of this is Israel today. But in 1948, when they became a nation, they left all that for what they considered were Syrians and people who were in there already. But this is Israel in 1948. Right now, it goes all the way up the Jordan River. That's Israel. It actually takes, this. But it's just showing you how much bigger it was in the day of King David and King Solomon. All right, you got the Song of David, Roman numeral 5, the last words of David. David's 33 mighty men and their victories. The three mightiest of the mighty men are described as Adino the Esnite. He slew 800 men single-handedly. He's the greatest of all the mighty men. Phenomenal. I saw a Christian drew a picture of this man, just trying to imagine. You can't fight, today like they fought then. It's very hard to comprehend. The way that the battle, the people would come into a valley and they would fight, and when you would drive a sword through and you would kill somebody, you'd have to turn around and you'd have to fight, defend yourself against somebody else, and then fight. Ultimately, you're standing on this pile of bodies, and so he's moving around, but underneath this guy, after the end of the battle, is 800 bodies. Now, when they show King Henry V and they show some of the films, you see this battlefield filled with people, but they're all spread out. It didn't actually look like that. It would have been impossible to imagine, but I saw this guy. He had this picture of this worn-out man, and he's got his sword, but there are piles of people that he's had to defend. It's like we call it the king of the hill, the king of the mountain. Well, that's where it came from.
Doesn't Jonathan and his armor bearers kind of wing look very insignificant compared to...
Yeah, but there's no comparison. I mean, Jonathan was a brave man, but this guy was a very strong man, capable. I mean, how many? It's hard to kill a guy. All right, let's just put it that way. And then to stand and to keep fighting, wielding this 25-pound sword and having a 25-pound, or I'll say it's a 15-pound sword and a 25-30-pound shield, and you're blocking blows and defending yourself and cutting up with the other, you can only do that for so many minutes before you and I would collapse. And he kept going. So he's called the mightiest of the mighty men. You have another guy named Eliezer. He fought all alone until his sword, they couldn't even pry his hand from the sword. and he wrought a great victory that day. And then the third guy, Shem, he was considered a brave man because what happened was when Israel was waiting for the battle, and there was no battle, so they all left, but this one guy standing there, and with nobody else around, he's standing in this, what they call a pea patch, we would say where we're from. It's a bean field, a field of lentils, L-I-L-E-N-T-I-T-I-L-S, in a field of lentils. The Philistine army attacks, and he goes, there was nobody to help, so he just stands there, and he defends that plot of ground, and he wins. And so he's marked as a very brave man. There are three other mighty men who do something absolutely wonderful. David is in the cave of Adullam. He's running from Saul, and he's not particularly thirsty. He just wishes he could be back home in Bethlehem. He says, I wish I could have a drink from the water of the well. And he just whispers it. He doesn't ask as many things, but three of his men overhear him. And that night, they all night go through all of the checkpoints and all of the Philistine garrisons, and they risk their life, and they get into Bethlehem. At that point, was completely controlled by the Philistines, and they snuck in there, let down a bucket, brought up the water, and got it all the way back at their own risk, and brought this drink of water from the well of Bethlehem to David because they loved David that much. Those men are great men. And when it lists, then you have 30 mighty men. Then you have the last thing, which is David's sinful census, CENSUS.
I told me I'll get there last night, remember?